From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we'll learn about the Youth Violence Prevention Initiative. It's organized by the Medical College of Wisconsin and four partner agencies. Then how a new play might make talking about abusive relationships easier.
And a lot of us are in relationships, you know, that we wouldn't term as being abusive. But a person seeing the show might ask themselves the question, I'm wondering if some parts of my relationship right now might lean toward an abusive relationship. I didn't realize that.
We'll have springtime gardening tips from Melinda Myers, and our sports contributor talks about Ryan Braun's reaction to being a pariah in opposing ballparks.
He hit three home runs in the Phillies' home opener, and I don't know if there's any fan base in baseball that likes booing somebody as much as Philadelphia's does, but they picked the wrong guy to boo, apparently.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Since 2008, a coalition of groups has been working to stem the cycle of youth violence in the Milwaukee area under the umbrella of the Youth Violence Prevention Initiative. Organized by the Medical College of Wisconsin's Healthier Wisconsin Partnership Program, the effort plays out through four partner agencies, including the Holton Youth and Family Center. On the heels of a student summit on violence last weekend, the initiative is organizing a march across the 16th Street Viaduct this weekend in an effort to spotlight their violence prevention work. Ahead of that event, we're joined in the studio by Katie Polis, Program Director at the Holton Youth and Family Center, Janelle Grimes, a 15-year-old volunteer at the center, and by Anthony Caples, Community Outreach Coordinator for the Violence Prevention Initiative. Caples tells Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke he believes the initiative is already paying dividends for the community.
I would say the difference that is being made as far as the VPI is concerned is we have really put a concerted effort in our partnerships. The VPI is mainly established of 29 different partnerships throughout the city of Milwaukee, and so the cross-collaboration has been the key to our success of our program.
What do you think – what's the role of the Holton Center in this equation? What are you doing?
So without the Violence Prevention Initiative, the Holton Youth and Family Center would quite possibly not be able to be open the way it is today. Our center was closed for a number of years, and with the help of VPI, we were able to reopen it. So now that we're reopened, we're serving lots of kids and families in the River West and Harambe community trying to really work to reduce violence – teach kids to make really positive choices within the center and in their community to try to build capacity to reduce violence in the neighborhood.
And that's one of the things that you volunteered to do, correct?
Yes.
So how do you do it?
Walking in them doors, walking inside the doors and feeling the peace. But when you walk in there, you set free, your wings just float you away. It's home. It's not really a lot to say if you go in there.
Well, but maybe both of you can talk about how you go from a life that really isn't very peaceful. What are the ways that the Holton Youth and Family Center takes this issue and tries to break the cycle?
So I think that for a lot of our young people, they are facing a number of adversities in their life. We call those risk factors. And they face those for no reason except for where they live and who they are. And so what we try to do is reduce those risk factors and give them hope and give them opportunities to build character and build strength and find ways to be more positive so that they can be changed, not that we're changing them or their neighborhood, but that they're changing themselves in their neighborhood. And I think that we're starting to really see some change in how young people are interacting with each other and with their community.
Do you see people walk through the doors who were where you were just a few years ago? I mean, there must be you must see a lot of people who aren't as far along as you are.
Yeah, I ain't gonna say no names, but it's this one young man around my age. He don't have it all, but when he come in there, he laughs, he giggles, he have fun, and he feel that it's family there for him, that care for him, that'll always be on his side. He one of my closest friend. I always be there for him. But when he there, we all family. He got a mom, a dad, brother, sister. You got a whole family that you can celebrate with anytime, any moment. And that's the place that you could go.
Do you think that makes a difference to you and to this young man and the other people when they're outside the doors, when they actually have to leave the center itself?
Yeah, because when you leave there, you're happy just for the rest of the week. From Monday to Friday, you're going to be happy just because you walked in them doors.
How would you say the stuff that goes on at the Holton Youth and Family Center fits into the larger equation of everything that the Violence Prevention Initiative is about?
I would say because of the public health approach that we're taking with violence prevention, we find that it's just really rooted in community outside of the entire scope of research, that for us to have effect for our community is to have our community be interactive. And centers like the Holton Youth and Family Center are a perfect example of it just not being for the kids, but the entire family. And so there's entire community involvement that we feel has been very impactful on the lives that of the people that we serve.
How do you reach the right people? I mean, what about the people that don't come into the Holton Youth and Family Center or to any of the other partners? How do you reach the people that might be missed?
So I think it's twofold. I think our young people do an awesome job at spreading the word. We rarely do recruitment because word of mouth is so strong. So our young people who enjoy the program will go out and get their friends and their cousins, brothers, sisters, and bring them to the center. But our staff and the VPI team do a lot of community outreach. So we'll go out into the neighborhood, knock on doors, walk down the street, host block parties, do cleanups, find ways to get out into the community. For some people, they're not ready to step into a program that maybe is more structured, or they don't have transportation, or they may not feel comfortable in that environment. But we want to be able to reach them where they're at. And we can do that in a number of ways, including reaching out into the community.
Well, who are the people that are running the programs?
So the majority of the staff are from Milwaukee, born and raised. They're from the neighborhood. We have one staff person, Tori Johnson, who's our site manager, and he's like a celebrity in the community. We walk down the street with him. Everybody knows his name. He's been in the community for years, and he's trusted in the community. And I think a lot of our staff are. And we're not supplanting them in the community. They come from within. And so I think that builds trust and makes it work.
Was there one person that made a real difference to you?
Tori Johnson. He knows some people that, you know, they want to raise right. But when they talk to him, they want to change their life. They want to go to the positive road instead of walking down the bumpy road. So that's why I say him, he's my grandfather. I'm always think about him.
Would you like it someday if people thought of you the same way?
People already look up to me. I'm always be somebody to look up to. I'm a leader. Always have been.
Is it ever hard to live up to?
No.
What if we asked you that question 3 years ago?
That question 3 years ago, I say, yeah. That's 3 years ago. This me now.
So what changed?
It's a difference. If we're different from me, not going to the whole new family, sitting on Sundays, the hoop, to going there daily. When you go on Sundays, that's just one day of the week. But you go daily, that's love all through the week. It's a difference from going one day to 5 days.
How do you ensure this initiative has the same kind of effect on everybody?
It's been our goal to bring as much attention to the great work and tell the stories that are taking place, such as with the Holton Center and our other partners, such as ONCOM and Ripple Effect and Milwaukee Public Schools. We definitely want to tell their stories through our various community meetings, committees, through social media, our website. It is a constant daily of sharing the stories and the great work that is happening in the community with our partners. And so there's no real set formula that we do, because all the great work that they do is organic. It's a daily process. It's a daily challenge. At the Holton Center, the staff, they have different challenges and different triumphs every day. And we feel that just being connected to tell those stories are going to be that catalyst to actually bring the community back together and to get that story out to those that might not know of the great work that's being taking place.
We've heard about the successes, but what are some of the challenges you still deal with every day?
I think there's a lot of challenges. Violence is an epidemic in our city, and it didn't get here overnight. It's not going to change overnight. And I think we're working really hard to help people understand that our small victories along the way are helping our issue with youth violence in the city, and also getting the word out that everybody's accountable for violence in our community. It's not just the people who are committing violence or dealing with violence. We're all part of this Milwaukee community, and we all need to work together to prevent youth violence. We all need to lift our youth up and be role models for them. So I think the biggest challenges are just time. You know, we have to be a little bit patient in working on this problem, and just awareness that we need everybody's help, that we can't do it alone.
So it's going to be one of those things where we're not really going to know how successful it was until 10 or 15 years go by and we see what the young people of today are like as adults?
Correct. One of the hardest things to put a finger on is, what does prevention look like? And for us, prevention is telling the positive stories of what our youth and our families are doing. It's not so much of the negative spin that we might say that, oh, okay, we helped kick this child out of jail. We all had the potential to do great things, and we all had the potential to do bad things. And we feel that it's our goal as part of the VPI is to tell those great stories, to show those great outlets that our youth and our families are doing, and how they are building the community and re-strengthening things. I remember a time period prior to the Holton Center being closed and saying that there was a great center there prior to, but, you know, the families and the youth did not go away. And so just being a part of this opportunity to help revitalize that community is a great example of prevention.
Well, let me ask you, if someone started bugging you today, I mean, we talk about what violence prevention means. If you were in a situation where there was somebody that was really bothering you, how would you deal with them today versus, say, 3 years ago?
Today, 3 years ago, I would have did the opposite of what I would have did today. See, I have a mentor, Mr. Smith, at the Honey Family Center. He taught, but he talked to certain people certain ways, because it's a lot of people that's out there that's going to give up on themselves. When you fight, what is it going to get you? A ticket or behind bars or more trouble on your back? So what I would have did today is I probably would have, you know, turned around and said a couple words, but at the end of the day, I would have walked away, went home, got in the shower, and did the daily routine. That's what I always would do. But 3 years ago, I wouldn't have probably did that.
Would you hit him?
I might have.
Before we wrap up, there's a march happening this weekend, and I was hoping you might tell us a little more about it.
So on April 12th, which is this Saturday, we are inviting everyone in Milwaukee to come out to the Father Grappi Unity Bridge, the 16th Street Viaduct, and march with us for peace in Milwaukee, signifying that we all have stake in this and we're all coming together to make Milwaukee a peaceful place, a safer place to live.
Well, thanks to all three of you, and really, good luck in your work.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Katie Polis is program director at the Holton Youth and Family Center, and Janelle Grimes is a volunteer there. Anthony Caples is community outreach coordinator for the Violence Prevention Initiative, which is based at the Medical College of Wisconsin. They spoke with Mitch Tyke. The Violence Prevention Initiative marks Youth Violence Prevention Week with a march across the James E. Grappi Unity Bridge, also known as the 16th Street Viaduct, this Saturday morning at 9:30. A new student play takes on violence and unhealthy relationships. We'll learn more when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio, and I'm Bonnie North. There are a lot of ways to talk about violence in relationships, but theater might be one of the most powerful methods. A new play, Surviving the Cycle, produced by the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare, uses students from various departments at UWM and Marquette University, as well as community members, to explore the nature of abusive relationships. Playwright Richard Gustin, who also teaches at UW Fond du Lac, and Professor Roberta Hannes from the Bader School join Lake Effect's Stephanie Lecce in the studio, and Hannes describes how this community collaboration came to be.
Well, I take a group of students to Costa Rica during the winter. Actually, we have a great study abroad program in the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare, trying to get students outside of the Milwaukee area and into other areas of the world. And, of course, domestic violence is something that is worldwide. It's occurs everywhere. It's been around since the beginning of time, perhaps. And while we were in Latin America, we visited some of the social service agencies that are down there, one of which is a domestic violence shelter. Just happened to be with Richard's daughter, who is one of our graduate students at UWM. And we started talking about the importance of this topic and how we could highlight it and bring it into the students' lives with more understanding, because we don't really give it enough attention, in my opinion, when it really is underlying so many other issues. So consequently, Katie Gustin said, "My dad wrote this play." So great. Just so happens we had the good fortune to meet with Richard. And
one thing led to another. Roberta and I met on campus and said, "Why don't we do this together?" She said, "That sounds good." I said, "That sounds great. Let's have auditions. Let's do this."
And now it's truly a collaboration, because we have students from Marquette. We have students from the School of Social Welfare, quite a few that are in the play, as well as students from the film
department. The female lead is a MSW, Master's of Social Work student at UWM.
Yes. So there's a lot of collaboration from people who responded to the auditions and were up and running and were excited to be having the play.
Mm-hmm. Well, so tell me a little bit more about Surviving the Cycle. What will audiences see performed on stage? What is the story that's being performed?
Well, the story revolves around a family, a traditional American family of a man and wife and their two kids. It really revolves around them and their dynamic. The two sons, the expectations from the parents, the teenage angst of the two kids, their problems communicating, the problems that they have communicating in that four-person dynamic of a dominant male father figure who is quite violent. Well, he's very violent. And how he terrorizes that household and how the kids adjust to that and whether they talk about it or not. And then there are ensemble pieces. We have 12 company members. There are ensemble pieces that flex in and out of the show that revolves around. Becky, the mother, is really the central character. And what is she going to do? What's her situation? How typical is her situation as a female, as a female being dominated by her husband, who loves her husband very much but is really concerned about, is she being abused? Is this abuse? Is this the face of abuse? Or is this just normal? Is this how a man and wife behave? She's confused.
Roberta, what are you hoping that audience members are going to respond to in this play? What other questions are you hoping they're going to be walking away asking themselves?
Well, I think in addition to what Richard just said, I want to add that your audience is going to walk away looking at roles that exist in our culture, roles that exist in their lives, in their relationships, the roles that we've kind of oftentimes not questioned. And given by virtue of sometimes your gender, who's working, who's in charge, who's got the right,
who's got the money,
who's older, what are the expectations of a male in this culture? What are the expectations of a female? You know, people are taught, especially there are cultures all around the world, but in general, men are taught to be kind of intolerable, to not tolerate certain kinds of things with women. It's okay to to feel things that women are doing are offensive. We're all taught that being possessive of one another is actually a good thing. We should possess. We should get really possessive. And so there's a lot of confusion about what's the difference between intimacy and trust and feeling a need to possess someone and own them. These kinds of things are going to be in the play. And again, I don't think there's a one of us that doesn't somehow understand how that feels when it comes up in our relationships, or that we exhibit behaviors. All of us exhibit these behaviors. And again, we're somewhat encouraged. We begin to assume a sense of standard of thinking about who we are and how that plays itself out in oftentimes not just our behaviors in our family of origin, but then throughout the course of our lives, unless we really get some help. And oftentimes people don't talk about these things because they're so sensitive. The topic of violence in relationship is very, very sticky and difficult. Most people would prefer you not bring it up.
And a lot of us are in relationships, you know, that we wouldn't term as being abusive. We go, well, I'm not in an abusive relationship, but a person seeing the show might ask themselves the question, I'm wondering if some parts of my relationship right now might lean toward an abusive relationship. You know, I didn't realize that. I guess I didn't realize how unhappy I really am. And this play is bringing that out. It's drawing that out of me right now. And I guess I need to talk about that with my significant other or my friend or my parent.
How were you able to help the student actors who are putting on this play to navigate some of these questions, questioning these roles, these behaviors, their own relationships, and then also portray these negative behaviors on stage?
Because some of these ideas are very personal to them. I mean, there's an interface between the actors that are in the show and their personal lives, and with all of our lives. So sometimes there's some very difficult moments in the play. And I guess the way we're navigating that is they know that they're navigating that in the play for a higher good. It's not about them. It's about helping others, audience members coming. And so it's worth it. They're learning more about themselves, their own relationships, and they trust that audience members will be not just moved, but will be asking themselves the same questions, critiquing their own relationships.
So social work students, criminal justice students especially, but every student, every human being actually has to look at these issues. And oftentimes they're looking at it as it relates to their clients or the settings that they see the consumer in social services. But in fact, it's on both sides. Violence and communication and relationship doesn't take place over there. And so it's been wonderful to work with the students and to have them. They were very excited about having the opportunity to audition. And then many of them in auditioning were very honest and open about how these things are really things they know about. So and of course, that's true for all of us. So
as actors, as theater artisans, theater's therapeutic for everybody. Not just for the audience members. Theater is therapeutic for the actors. Mm. Actors find out more about themselves by taking on the skin of other people. You yourself imagine, what if I were that person? You imagine and you fantasize about that and maybe you journal about that. But to get up and to speak and to look in the eye of another person as that person, it's make-believe. Of course it's make-believe. But that's why it's so safe.
What has it meant to bring this production and be involved in this production to you both individually?
Well, I'm becoming acutely aware of how under-resourced or how under-discussed, how little understanding there really is on this particular topic of domestic violence. And not just domestic violence, but also how is it that we are all put through years and years and years of schooling, 12-plus years sometimes of education, and not a one of the courses that we've taken has something to do with how to be with another person in relationship. In other words, a full semester of just learning how to be in relationship without assuming either a dominant or a submissive role. And so when you know that that's actually going to make or break your happiness, your livelihood,
your
whole life. It's this idea that we don't actually start, and we can, from pre-kindergarten, teaching this particular subject of how to be yourself, how to be comfortable, what to do when someone disagrees with you, how to not just assume a relationship of, you know, falling back or pushing forward. How do you stay, row the boat, you know, in these experiences? So it's really brought to my attention the need for more education on things related to relationship.
Richard, how about you?
Well, the key thing about writing this play, or really anything I'm writing right now, is to be sure that I'm very careful not to write any villains. Nobody's a villain. Mm-hmm. Nobody's a villain in life. You know, in life, no one thinks of themselves as a villain.
Or an abuser.
No. They're trying to do the best they can. They actually think they're doing the right thing for various reasons. And they're doing the best they can. And as a matter of fact, they feel put upon. They feel boxed in. They feel confined in their life. Yes, they may have a high level of frustration, but they attribute their problems to others. We all do. If this weren't this way, if that person weren't such and such a way, I could be – well, it's a lack of personal responsibility. Now, I don't know about you, but in my life – that's, I guess, the number one lesson I have been taught in my life and continue to learn. How do I take responsibility for my own self? Well, these people in Surviving the Cycle are trying to figure that out. And they're all doing the best they can. Mm-hmm. In other words, an audience member sits there and goes, you know what? No, I'm not in a violent relationship, at least I don't think I'm in a violent relationship, but I've seen violence done unto others, or I've had violence done unto me, and I wonder, am I somehow responsible for that? By my silence? Not just by my actions, but by my silence? Well, that's what I'm hoping the theater can do for society. I think theater's transformative, this play especially.
Well, Richard Gustin and Roberta Hannes, thank you both so much.
Thank you so much for having
Thanks,
us.
Stephanie.
UW Fond du Lac Professor Richard Gustin wrote and directs Surviving the Cycle, a play about the nature of abusive relationships. Roberta Hannes is a clinical associate professor in the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UWM. The play debuts tonight at 7:30 at the Kenilworth Studio 508 on Milwaukee's East Side, and it runs through Sunday. Both Hannes and Gustin spoke with Stephanie Lecce. Well, spring is in the air, and gardeners of all kinds are eager to get outside. Melinda Myers joins us next to offer her expert tips when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect returns now. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. It's amazing the difference a couple of 60-degree days can make in your outlook. The sudden burst of spring-like weather has thousands of Milwaukeeans finally outside and doing the outdoor activities that the weather had made challenging until just recently. That includes gardening and other yard work, which was tough with more than 3 months' worth of snowpack on the ground. Garden expert and Lake Effect contributor Melinda Myers is just as relieved as the rest of us that the thaw has finally taken hold. She tells Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke about the pros and cons of such a long winter on the area's gardens.
Well, one of the good things is the snow, even though it was a pain in the neck to shovel and remove, was great insulation for our plants. And it came before the really severely cold temperatures. So that's helped our plants throughout the winter. Plus, it's, you know, resupplying the groundwater as it melts. So that's the good part. The bad part is a lot of insects have no problem surviving the cold temperatures. You know, a lot of people were hoping, oh, it's the end of emerald ash borer or Japanese beetle. But no, it's not. They have kind of an antifreeze in their system. And since we had a slow cool down in the fall, they got ready for the winter, and they've been found to survive temperatures colder than what we had this winter. And the Japanese beetle larvae are deep in the ground, so they're below the snow, so they're well insulated. Now, the good news is there might be a few insects that did succumb to this, but we also have some things that we need to watch for in our lawn, as you mentioned. Let's start with the grass. any place that snow was piled or lingered or is still lingering. Mm-hmm. You want to make sure you lightly rake that to kind of fluff up the grass, and that will help discourage snow mold. If you didn't get out and do that, you might see some matted down grass. You may see some gray or pink kind of fuzzy fungal growth. So you're going to want to replace that once the soil does warm up, rake off the dead, loosen that soil, and put some grass seed down. Some may be seeing some trails from voles. Those are those little critters that are like meadow mice that eat seeds and chew on bark of trees and shrubs and maybe even the roots of hostas and daylilies. Now, the grass part's easy. Just kind of tamp down the trails and reseed if they're large areas. And then for the trees and shrubs, you're just going to have to wait and see if they come back. For perennials, you know, once the soil is workable, dig, remove the damaged portion. You can compost that and then replant them after preparing the soil, either if you put them back in the existing spot or start a new garden with those divisions.
Are mushrooms likely to be a big issue this spring?
You know, with the drought of 2012, I know it's hard to even remember that, the heat and the drought, a lot of trees and shrubs succumbed to that. And so we had a lot of root dieback or plant dieback. And this winter might be enough to finish them off. So if we've had any trees or shrubs dying or we've removed some and we have their old root systems in the ground, that's where we see a lot of mushrooms in the ground. And so you may be seeing during wet weather the fruiting bodies. The good news is once they're done decomposing those dead roots in the ground, then the problem disappears. So a lot of gardeners like to rake up those mushrooms so the kids and pets don't eat them.
As we've noted, spring has been pretty slow in coming. How far behind are we on the kinds of things that you would normally like to have gotten done in the yard?
You know, I've talked to people who just couldn't wait and did a lot of cleanup. That's about all we can do. The good news is if you haven't gotten around to your dormant season pruning, you know, things like summer blooming shrubs, there's still time because things are still dormant. Wait until after blooming for your, you know, spring flowering things like lilacs and forsythia. We're a few weeks behind. A lot of it's going to depend on the next month's worth of temperature, how fast we'll see things blooming. And the other thing to keep in mind is just because it's not leafed out doesn't mean it's dead. Be extra patient this year, not only to plant. We want to make sure the soil's warm before we put those tomatoes in the ground. But we also want to wait and make sure the plants have had a chance to break dormancy and start to grow. So it's going to be a late spring, and hopefully it slowly warms up, because when we get a quick hit of heat and then cold again, a freeze, that's when we lose our flower buds. It hurts our fruit crops. So as much as I hate to see this slow warm up, at least if it stays consistently cool instead of really hot, really cold, really hot, it's better for our plants.
You know, that's another one of the interesting things about this spring is, you know, in my part of Wauwatosa, there are years that I see tulips starting to come out of the ground in late January, early February, and it really has only been in the last week that the shoots have even started coming out of the ground in our area.
You bet. And that's one of the things that's fun to do with a journal is kind of have those plants. I had winter aconite, some early bloomers in my city lot. The earliest they ever bloomed was March 4th. Think about March 4th this year. They did not come up, needless to say, and they're still not up. In some years, it's tax day, or I think this year it's going to be even later. You know, and it's very spotty. Berner Botanical Gardens a week ago was reporting some winter aconites blooming. Some people may have bulbs near their house that are blooming in those warm spots. So it's going to be interesting to see how things develop.
Well, let's talk about how people could get a jump on things, because it is clearly too early to be putting new stuff into the ground at this point. What about the idea of planting seeds indoors to maybe get off to a hopeful start?
You know, and also to get that gardening fix we all need so badly. One of the things you always want to do is check the seed packet, and it will tell you how many days before the last frost, how many weeks to start plants indoors. Now, unless you're going to jumpstart the season, pay attention to that. You know, tomatoes we typically plant out in late May, early June. So we typically start those indoors in early March. Cabbage, broccoli, pansy should have already been started, but at this rate, you have nothing to lose. So look for that and follow those directions. The other thing you can do is if you do want to jumpstart the season, start some plants indoors and then warm the soil outside. So prep the soil as soon as we can get out there and dig into it. Cover it with clear plastic for a couple weeks. That will warm it up. Also sprout some of those weed seeds. Lightly cultivate, plant and then cover it with a floating row cover. That can protect your plants down to 24 degrees. So you could be planting your tomatoes in early May, even mid-April. If you do all that, well, maybe early May, since it is already there in April, but it'll at least give you a jump start so that you can harvest earlier. The other thing is I often use floating row covers even when I plant in late May. Think about last June. I saw a lot of damage on tomatoes because the temperatures were cool and it delayed harvest. So you can even plant at the normal time, use those floating row covers to speed up harvest.
And the key to knowing when to transfer the plants outdoors is when the soil has warmed up.
You bet. So we're really talking in the 50s, 55. That's when we're starting to seed our lawn. Those are cool weather plants. We want it in the 60s for the tomatoes and things like that. You know, I just finally invested in a soil thermometer. It's only going to measure down a few inches, but you know what? It's a good way to really judge. I usually use the plants that are growing in my yard, but I have a new location that I'm gardening now, different spot in southeast Wisconsin, so I'm using some extra help in terms of monitoring temperature.
Well, great. Melinda Myers, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Melinda Myers is the author of numerous books on gardening, including her latest, The Midwest Gardener's Handbook, and Month-by-Month Gardening in Minnesota and Wisconsin. She's also the host of Melinda's Garden Moments on television, and she is our regular gardening contributor as well. She spoke with Mitch Teich. Enthusiasm is wonderful when it comes time to tackle your spring gardening chores, but spine specialist Kim Litwack says your back might not be quite up to the task so quickly. Litwack of the Milwaukee area's Advanced Pain Management tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce how to prep your back to prep your garden.
The biggest issue is that we've been doing not a whole lot of anything all winter because it's been so cold, nobody's wanted to do much of anything. We're going to walk outside and look at our backyards and look how trash they are from the winter and want to fix that. And then we're going to want to plant, and we're going to want to rake, and we're going to want to paint. So there's a whole lot of activities that will end up on our to-do lists. And we're going to face that weekend coming up and say, I've got 2 days to get everything that I can do done. So we're going to push it.
And what kind of strain will that put on us?
Well, depending on the activity, if you're raking, for example, we're going to feel it across our shoulder blades and down the arms. If you're climbing ladders and painting, again, shoulders and arms and back. It's just muscle strain. You're going to feel it not so much that day, but the next day you're going to go to get out of bed and think, oh my, what have I done? So you want to be as smart as you can be when you're doing it. Don't plant your entire garden. Don't rake your entire lawn in one sitting or one day of activity. If you're down on your knees gardening, put pads under your knees. If you don't have a pad, roll up a towel and put it under your knees. Alternate your left arm and your right arm so that you're not overdoing it with one side. And take breaks. Sit back, have a cup of coffee, and enjoy the work that you've done and be proud of what you've done. Give yourself a break and then get back into it.
Are there any stretches or ways we can prepare ourselves?
I would suggest just taking it easy at the beginning. Go take a walk around the block and look for signs of spring and really appreciate this great weather that we've had. But then just stretching out beforehand, core strengthening, bending with your knees, gentle stretches, even floor exercises of if you're strong enough and fit enough for planking, go ahead and plank. Otherwise, just gentle stretching of every joint and muscle.
You mentioned planking as a great way to strengthen the core muscles. Mm-hmm. What are some other easy exercises we can incorporate into our daily routine that can just strengthen some of those muscles so that way we're ready to get out there in the dirt?
Well, again, it's core strength. Our core is going to be stronger than our extremities. So we want to, you can plank, leg lifts, butt lifts. If you're sitting on the floor, get that bottom up off the ground. It may not go very far the first time, but hopefully it gets a little higher each time. For guidance, I could suggest one easy resource, which is our website with Advanced Pain Management. There's a section there called Healthy Living, and there's lots of stretching and strengthening that you can find under the Education tab. You can also work with your gym or fitness center, and whether it's a trainer or taking a class to get gently into those activities, just keep moving. Strengthen the core.
What are some of the most common complaints people have after they've done a hard weekend's work of gardening and preparing their lawns and gardens?
It's repetitive stress. It's using muscles again and again and again. It's that reaching and raking, for example, or reaching and painting or reaching and pulling that you just keep doing over and over and over. Pulling four weeds is one thing, but pulling a day's worth of weeds, you're going to feel it the next day.
All right. So say we haven't listened to you and your in your suggestions. What do we do after the fact?
Well, I don't listen to myself either sometimes. So I appreciate that question. It's not time to stop moving and stop and just say that I'm not going to do anything. This is a time to gently stretch, ice if it's swollen, over-the-counter anti-inflammatories if you are able to take those with your medical history, and just take it easy. Those aches and pains will go away. But if they're debilitating or you've got absolutely limited or frozen range of motion, that's time to seek help with your primary care provider.
Are there other tools that we should be using to make our jobs a little easier when we're either raking or gardening or cleaning the garage, for instance?
Well, using proper equipment. As an example, I went to anchor trellis in the garden this weekend, and I needed to put a stake in the ground and decided to pound it in with my foot as opposed to pounding it in with a sledgehammer. That wasn't a smart thing to do, and I felt it the next day. No permanent damage, but perfect example. Making sure the rake's the right size, making sure you're not doing abnormal reaching if you're up on a ladder trying to paint. Right size equipment for the right size hands.
We'll go a little bit more into that. What is the right size rake?
When you're raking and you're in a standing up position, you don't want to be doing a lot of bending over. You want to use your core, you want to use your arms, not your back. So if you require to bend over a lot with your rake, it's probably too short.
Well, Kim Litwack, thank you so much.
Thanks for the invitation.
Kim Litwack is a family nurse practitioner specializing in spinal care at Advanced Pain Management. She spoke with Stephanie Lecce. Well, spring isn't just a time to work in gardens. It's also a time to work in the fields, like the infield and the outfield. It's all about baseball when sports contributor Howie Magner joins us on Lake Effect right after this. We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Baseball season is into its second week, and while it's still really early in the 162-game schedule, the results have been promising for the Milwaukee Brewers, thanks in large part to a 3-game sweep of the Boston Red Sox last weekend in Boston. Back from his long suspension last year, Ryan Braun is drawing cheers at home and boos on the road, but his hitting has picked up where it left off before the eventful 2013 season. Howie Magner writes the Sports Nut column for Milwaukee Magazine, and he's our regular sports contributor. He tells Lake Effect's Mitch Teich that the Brew Crew gets high marks for the beginning of the 2014 campaign.
It's pretty amazing what happens when your team is healthy and you go out and improve on a pitching staff that, you know, probably was supposed to be okay last year. One of the big things that's helping out is Yovani Gallardo is pitching like a lot of people expected Yovani Gallardo to pitch like last year. He hasn't allowed a run yet. And when your starting pitchers throw shutout ball, you're off to a pretty good start. But it hasn't just been Gallardo. Kyle Loesch, even though he struggled with control a little bit in his most recent start, still pitched well enough to win. The bullpen has pitched very well.
There was some quick early turnover at the at the closer's position. Everybody expected Jim Henderson to have the job. All of a sudden, it was K-Rod.
Yeah, that was kind of an opening day surprise pulled off by manager Ron Renneke, but it's a surprise that's worked out pretty well. The concern was that Jim Henderson hadn't really thrown the ball as well in spring training as the Brewers had hoped he would. And it wasn't just that he wasn't throwing the ball well. It's that he wasn't hitting the speeds that he normally hit last year when he was having so much success. And so rather than risk things, the Brewers had, you know, K-Rod, Francisco Rodriguez, waiting in the wings. And so he's a guy who's got plenty of closers experience. He's actually, I believe, he has the second highest save total of active pitchers in Major League Baseball.
And still holds the
right
single season all-time saves record, right? Or he set it.
He set it back when he was with the Angels. You're going to embarrass my baseball trivia. I don't know if it's been...
BaseballReference.com tells us that indeed his 62 saves are still an all-time single season saves record.
it's looking like a pretty savvy signing from a baseball standpoint for Doug Melvin. Because,
this is a guy that everybody thought was kind of on a downhill trajectory.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, the Brewers traded him mid-season. It's almost been like a series of 1 year deals where they brought him in if you remember originally from the Mets in the middle of their last playoff run, and they brought him in basically to be the setup guy to John Axford, and then everybody expected they'd just cut him loose because he had a really high salary, and it was in the neighborhood of $10 million, $12 million, and that's a heck of a lot of money to pay for a setup guy, man.
Yeah.
So everybody expected him to be cut loose, but he ended up back with the Brewers at, I want to say, an $8 million deal for arbitration purposes, which is still an awfully high number to pay for a setup man. But yeah, he's just kind of stuck around with the Brewers, and it's really paying off this year because he's really helped solidify the bullpen, and that's even though he had a rough spring in the sense that he stepped on a cactus. And so that kind of messed up his preparation. But it's not even just K-Rod. I mean, Brandon Kinsler has pitched really well. Will Smith, the left-hander who they got in the Noriel Oki trade from the Royals, has pitched really well. So across the board, the Brewers pitching staff has just been stellar to the point where the starters, I believe, have the best starting ERA in the league. And earlier in the week, they had the best staff ERA in Major League Baseball. So and then you pair that with the offense, which had started slow in the opening series against the Braves, but really started to catch fire in the Boston series and continued that into the Philly series. And that was really punctuated by Ryan Braun.
Right. He continues to be a big story, getting big ovations in Milwaukee and lots of boos on the road. And so far, it does not seem to have gotten to him. In fact, maybe it's a motivator.
I was going to say, he said he hit 3 home runs in the Phillies home opener. And I don't know if there's any fan base in baseball that likes booing somebody as much as Philadelphia's does. But they picked the wrong guy to boo, apparently, because he really appears to be motivated by it. In fact, after the game, he said he loves it. The competitor in him really thrives on the boos. And there was a lot of concern with his thumb flaring up again, and the question was, why didn't he have surgery on the thumb in the off season? Well, he had like 2 surgical options basically. One was going to leave him with a numb thumb for the rest of his life. The second option wouldn't have left him in that situation, but it wasn't a guarantee that it was going to work. So they hoped that just resting it in the off season would improve it enough to where it wouldn't be an issue anymore. That didn't happen. But he's made some adjustments recently with padding in his batting glove and how he's swinging the bat that appears to be paying off. The question for Brewers fans going forward is, well, as the rigors of the season take effect, how is it going to play out with Braun? But right now, it looks like he's kind of back to his old self as far as swinging the bat goes. And then behind him, you've got Aramis Ramirez is going great guns. Carlos Gomez has picked up where he left off. The Brewers line, Chris Davis, who's the young kid who really came out of nowhere last year to help boost the offense, and now he's back in the lineup along with Braun, along with a healthy Ramirez, along with a Carlos Gomez. And everybody forgets about Jonathan Lucroy, who's might be the most underrated catcher in all of baseball, and he's off to a great start. So the Brewers really are hitting on all guns coming out of the gates, and that's a refreshing change for Brewers fans.
Well, and safe to say that this season has begun as well as they could have hoped.
I don't know what else you'd want. I mean, maybe a sweep of the Braves in the opening series, and that didn't quite happen. But
heck, they swept the Red Sox, though.
Well, they swept the defending world champions at Fenway Park, and I want to say this stat came out when it happened, but I want to say it's the first time the Red Sox have been swept at home since the 1980s or the 1990s, which is a heck of a long time.
But they didn't lose 3 consecutive games all last year.
Exactly. Well, they're the world champs. I mean, there's a reason they're the world champs. And if you can go in there with all the pomp and all the circumstances of the Red Sox getting their World Series rings and knock them out the way the Brewers did, and then to go on to Philly and do the same thing there in their home opener. I mean, the Brewers are 3-0 in home openers this season. I got to believe that's a record that's never going to be beaten. It might be matched sometime, but through a quirk of the scheduling, the Brewers have played 3 home openers, their own, Boston's Philly. They've prevailed in every single one. They're off to a heck of a start, and Brewers fans just hope that it continues.
Well, so let's tick off a bunch of different basketball stories that have happened since we last talked. Starting with, we actually had a chance to chat about Buzz Williams' departure from Marquette in the time since we talked. The Golden Eagles have hired a new basketball coach, taking a guy away from Duke, of all places.
Steve Wojciechowski. I hope I got that right for you Marquette fans, but I think I nailed it. Yeah, he's the longtime assistant coach on Coach K's staff, and I think I'm just going to start calling him Coach W in honor of Coach K, and that way you don't have to worry about pronouncing or spelling Wojciechowski. But, you know, you can make the argument that Wojciechowski actually has a better pedigree coming into this job than Tom Crean did when he was coming out, or when Buzz Williams did when he got the job, because Wojo is really had a heck of a run over there at Duke, and you're not going to find a more successful basketball program in the country than Duke, and you're not going to find a better mentor to study under than Coach K. So I think there's a lot of excitement over at Marquette about the hiring, and that comes after some trepidation. I mean, there were a lot of rumors out there, and I don't know how true they are, that Shaka Smart, the Virginia Commonwealth coach, was their first choice. And there was talk, oh, it was a done deal. He was hired, blah, blah, blah. Didn't come to pass. There were other talk that Ben Hallen was in the mix and some other guys. But Wojciechowski's name really didn't pop up until late in the search. Often that leads to questions about whether or not he's your first choice. Look, I don't think that matters. What matters is he a good fit for the program? And all indications seem to be that that's the case. He comes from a tradition-rich program in Duke. He's going to a tradition-rich program at Marquette. Obviously, there had to be something about Marquette that pried him away from Coach K, because he had job offers before and he didn't take them. But he saw something in the Marquette job that led him to believe that, yeah, it's time to leave the nest. I think Marquette fans, after what was at times a contentious search, really can be happy with the guy that Marquette landed, and it gives them reason to be optimistic going forward.
Speaking of reason for optimism, the Wisconsin Badgers season ended short of a national championship, but they made it to the national semifinal. And so this has got to, if not leave the Badger fans with the perfect taste in their mouth, certainly make them pretty happy about the way the season went.
Yeah, it's always hard when you get so close and don't get to the mountaintop, and especially after the way the finals played out. I'm guessing there isn't a single Badgers fan who doesn't think that if they had just gotten that last bucket against Kentucky, they could have gone on and won the national championship. But look, don't cry over spilled milk. It was a heck of a season. It's the first Final Four run at the Division I level for Coach Bo Ryan, and it was just so much fun to watch. I think the Badgers players took their fans on a wild ride. And not only that, but there's reason to believe that it could actually be better next year. They have, I want to say, 80% of their scoring coming back. Four of the five starters on this year's team are expected to be back. After the loss, Sam Decker, Frank Kaminsky said they're coming back. The only big gun that you're losing off that Badgers roster is Ben Bruss, and there's a couple of other role players.
Howie, thanks.
Thanks, Mitch.
Howie Magner is Lake Effect's regular sports contributor. He's also senior editor at Milwaukee Magazine, and he writes the Sports Nut column for its website. He spoke with Mitch Teich. And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.